Off the Ball, GAA.
This was a game where, like, there's a 7-day turnaround for these All-Ireland Junior Intermediate Finals. It's so tight.
Oh, Tommy, there was bodies everywhere. Like a war zone. It was amazing.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah.
I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12. I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No, no. Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.
Hey! Hello, hello, and welcome to Word on the Street. I'm Susanna, and it feels so good to be sat back in here. Happy 2026, to be honest. I know for the listeners, you won't have had a kind of break from Word on the Street, but we haven't actually been in here all together since last year. So I'm so happy to say, Eve, Rachel, we're back in studio. How are we feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling like I missed it, you know?
Yeah, it's a much less pressurised situation than we were here for the Nullagan Man episode last week where everything was live. Big shout out to Eve as well, who did the Sunday paper review and her own football slot all live on national radio. And yeah, to you too, Susanna.
3.5 hours did you do in the end?
I did 3.5 hours, but only 1.5 hours of that was live. Or I did 4 hours and only an hour and a half was live. I did a lot.
Yeah, a lot.
Which was scary.
But it was also the debut of our first full, I think our first full Word on the Street episode going out on national radio.
That was nice. So, didn't know it was our first.
Whoop. Snaps all around. But this week, we're also back to our traditional format, which is fun, of going out and talking to people on the street about some sort of sporting topic and then bringing all those voices back into the studio. So this week, it's episode 33, which is mental in itself, and it's called Lights, Camera, Action. And basically, it all kicked off when Rachel was at an event during the week and had a brilliant idea, as they do sometimes come.
Sometimes, all right, okay. I'll ignore that shade.
Yeah. So tell us, what were you at?
So on Tuesday, I was at the launch of Lake Regale. I don't know if listeners are familiar with it, but it's a documentary series ran by T.G. Cahir. This year is its 24th season, which is outrageous. I think they do eight players, eight lakes. Lake is the Irish word for hero, in case you're wondering.
24th season?
Yeah.
Over how many years?
I'd say 24.
Wow.
Don't quote me on that now.
Okay.
But like usually they bring out eight every year. You give that a little Google
yeah,
there.
Yeah, well, you
but
keep
yeah,
going.
It's renowned like just for being an incredible watch, not just for the sports people who are involved. Like most of the time you'd know them for their accolades on the pitch, but you get a real insight into their personal side of things as well. And a lot of the time you wouldn't have a clue what's going on behind closed doors, but you know, you don't in a lot of cases. But I think the GAA sometimes is interesting in that it's not as publicised as a lot of other sports in terms of, you know, because they're professional and you'd have the tabloids writing about soccer players, say, you know, whereas a lot of the GAA, it's more personal, it's more private. So getting an insight into these stories, it's phenomenal. So I got to chat to the eight new licks that are being featured this year. And I also got chatting to one of the directors, Cormac, who has directed over 30 episodes. He did three of them this season. And I was chatting to the players and I was like, oh, what was it like having the directors in there? And they all just kept saying how comfortable they were made to feel, because a lot of these people aren't media trained, you know, especially the older generation. So it's a, excuse me, my laptop is telling me to shut up even. It's a big deal for them. So they kept saying that trust was such an important thing. So I asked one of the directors, Cormac, what's so important about going about making documentaries like these?
I suppose what we've done over the years is we've built up trust between us and the players. They know we're not out to get a scoop or anything like that. We're just literally there to tell their story. That's the most important thing. And like, we're all sports fans. We want to kind of go on that little bit of a journey with them again. Even for me, like, it's amazing just to sit there in front of like Cyril or Connor and McPorrick and just hear their stories. And sometimes it's stuff that you can't, we can't get everything on screen. But even just to have the time to sit with them is brilliant. I'm very lucky for it. Well, first of all, you have to be very upfront with them, you know, from the get-go, from the very start. When you make the first phone call, you just you tell them that, like, look, we're talking about your sporting career, the highs and lows of that, but also, you know, the journey off the field to get there, to get to those points. And he was very straight up, very upfront about, you know, his own diagnosis of Parkinson's and what he's going through, what he's dealing with. And he was more kind of putting it on us. Are we able to handle it? Like, because he was well up for doing it. And so once you have that kind of trust, and once you know lads are they're open and they're willing to kind of go, you know, and talk about these things, then that's half the battle then, like, you know, because they love talking about the goals and the points, but it's when you get into the stories about, like, as I said, how they got there, you know, the journey to get there from their own personal life, that's when you realise how special they are, you know. It's not always the ones that have won everything either that are going to be the ones who are willing to sit down and tell their journey to get there. And sometimes it's lads who haven't gotten there, who will even, you know, there's so much heartache, and they kind of want to maybe almost give a little bit back, tell you why they didn't get there. And so yeah, it's maybe cathartic for them in a way sometimes, but it's just, we're so lucky that they're willing to do that. That's the most important part, and that, you know, they have a bit of trust in us to tell their story.
Busy place there. But by the way, over 24 years, it first aired on TG Car in May 2001. Oh, so there you go.
Yeah, and just one thing to note as well on it is it's always players who have retired. So it's never current players. It's one thing I wanted to let you know, because it led into a conversation then in the office afterwards as to, it's a fantastic documentary, but it doesn't get people watching GAA necessarily, because you can't watch someone on Lake Regale and then say, I can't wait to see what they do this season.
That's interesting.
Whereas we'll come to kind of the knock-on effects and other documentaries later on, that it's actively affecting viewership numbers in the following year.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, because I was going to say it's such a contrast in how much he talks about trust and the trust between the players and the production team, whereas that's, I think, been an issue in a lot of other kind of docuseries that we're seeing coming to light, like the, I know we're going to talk about it later, Eve, but like the F1 Drive to Survive, like that was a major hiccup for them in that they were maybe dramatizing things a little bit too much and lost the trust with some of their kind of key superstars.
Yeah, and I think that's what is particularly interesting about this, in that there's a certain element of, you can be trustful when you're no longer actively playing. It's very easy.
The story's written.
Yeah, exactly. You are in control now of how your legacy is, how you want that to be told. Whereas stuff like Drive to Survive, the All or Nothing Amazon Premier League documentaries, any really of the box-to-box production and Netflix deals, which is like the golf and the tennis and everything, when you're dealing with active players, that's suddenly, there's a narrative spun maybe around you that you didn't fully want out there, or that's painting you in a light that you don't see yourself in while you are still actively competing at the highest level of your sport. It's an incredibly different environment. And if Lake Regale was dealing with, you know, players who are currently active, like young players, that would be, it would be an entirely different product, I think.
Yeah, it's an entirely different show, to be fair. Like, that, the premise of the show is, you know, to honour heroes of the game that have gone before us. So there has been calls, especially we were talking to some people in the street, for, is a Lake Regale-esque thing for current players could be really beneficial for the likes of the GAA and for rugby as well?
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Is that what this clip is here?
It absolutely is.
Yeah. All right, Brona, can we play it?
The Michael Jordan documentary that was on Netflix, I think it was like 6 episodes, but it was just great to see the behind the scenes and the Dennis Rodman and stuff. So it's just mental how so different it is, like the Irish sports scene compared to the American sports scene, and the money that's in it, and the stuff they get up to off the court is pretty funny. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. Just good for the game, like all media and all attention on them. I think it's brilliant because people love to see the behind the scenes and their personalities. So I'd love to see it, obviously within reason, because some of the stuff he got up to now, it's probably wouldn't do it here, but you know, within reason, I think it's brilliant. I think it's just good for the game. Like,
would you tune in more to a little bit of NBA now, knowing what you know goes on behind the scenes?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's just, they create the character, their personalities so well, and especially around the guy and the rugby scene, just to build up more personalities. I think it's only good for the game. Like, you know, there's online media, you know, negative comments, stuff like that, but I think it's just, yeah, it's easier said than done, but I think it'd be great for the game. One was the Jim McGuinness one a couple of years back. I think that's maybe 10, 15 years. That was fantastic. I watched that and that was like the whole behind the scenes. That was brilliant.
It's funny he talks about Last Dance. That was the one with Michael Jordan, wasn't it? Mm. I watched that. That was incredible. I feel like that reached so many people that weren't basketball fans, which is, I suppose, the point of it, as he said. But then they had, I think it was recently announced as well, Rachel, you brought to my attention, they had another basketball docuseries on Netflix, which premiered last year. And there was meant to be a second season set to be released in early 2026. And that was also NBA focused. And it basically followed five kind of stars around the place. And they were big names. They had LeBron James in season one, Jimmy Butler, Anthony Edwards. And that has been cancelled, season two.
The thing about The Last Dance, did you watch it as well, Eve?
I actually missed that somehow.
Oh, you should go back and watch that. Okay. It's actually fantastic.
Yeah. It's brilliant. I think the circumstances into how it was delivered, like, it was COVID. They were, like, separated out. You couldn't binge watch it. You couldn't.
No,
it's like normal
couldn't.
People. You know, the
it
settings
had you on the edge of your seat every week waiting for the next one.
And, like, no one had anything else to do. But it's still an unbelievable documentary. And, yeah, I couldn't wait to watch the starting five basketball documentary. I enjoyed the first one. Like, I'm not a huge NBA fan. So I was more coming into the, like, oh, I can't wait to see what, like, LeBron James is like as a person. Mm. And the first season was fine. You know, usually if I'm watching a sports documentary, like, I'm locking in. But this is one, like, you'd keep one eye on it. And the second season, I finished it there the other day. So boring.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Like, is it Tyrese Halliburton? His girlfriend features in it a lot. And it's like, they spend an entire episode of her just being like, please propose to me soon. And he's like winking at the camera because he's got all of these secret plans to propose to her in Paris. And like, if that was a tiny bit of a story, maybe it'd be fine. But oh, it just took over and it was so cheesy. I didn't finish it, which is unheard of, really.
Yeah, that's almost a little bit too personal. Like, yes, we want the personal stories, but they still have to be related to the sport we're watching it for, I think. Like, if it's a completely random, like, oh, I'm waiting for this proposal, like, I could watch that from an influencer on TikTok. Like, I don't need to watch a full episode of
it's
that.
So cringe.
It's imbalanced. It's not, I'm not surprised to hear that it's been, well, cancelled or it's not coming back for a third season.
Yeah, like, top players in the game, like, it's, they should have done so much better with it, but it was boring.
That raises an interesting question that I know we're going to get to in a second, but whether it's enough to have just superstars in your documentary, because I think what we're seeing from a lot of the kind of more failed ones, even like the tennis Breaking Point, is that, and the Six Nations, the, what was it called, Full Contact, which we'll get to, they can have the biggest names in the sport and still the documentary won't kind of resonate with audiences.
Yeah, so there was, I think, six productions from Box to Box Production who do all of these kind of Netflix ones. So you have Six Nations Full Contact, which has been cancelled.
Mm.
You have Breakpoint for tennis, which has been cancelled. You have Tour de France Unchained, which has been cancelled.
And the only, you're like the Grim Reaper.
Sorry, Netflix.
The only two that are still going is Drive to Survive, which is the first one, the original kind of from 2018, and Full Swing with the golf. So it's almost like you would think something like the rugby is a far more popular sport in kind of the UK and Ireland and France and New Zealand and Australia, all these kind of, and excluding France, but Anglophone countries that be watching a lot of this. You'd think the rugby one would be so much more popular than, say, the tennis, where you didn't get, at least for the first season, the world number one. You know, you had kind of lesser characters in it.
I think the difference is, especially for the rugby, and I read this somewhere, I think it was an RTE article, where they were talking about how the Six Nations kind of lacked the drama of a lot of the other examples. But what also hindered it is that rugby union isn't a global sport.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get there, and that was part of why
I don't think that matters. I think you can have, like, the most ridiculous sport ever and that could only be played in one tiny town in a island off the coast of Papua New Guinea. But as long as the storytelling... Yeah, it is, yeah.
An island off the coast of an island?
Yeah.
Good example there, Richard.
An inlet, maybe, will we call it. But as long as the storytelling is good, people will watch it. I don't think it matters if the sport has global appeal or not. It's the storytelling. Like,
I mean, like Formula One, yeah, it's a global sport in that they travel everywhere, but there's only 20 guys who get to actually be an F1 driver. Whereas anyone technically within reason can play rugby.
No, it's true. And if you look at the tennis, I mean, that's a global sport. Travels all over the world, competitions all over the place. And that failed as well. So, yeah, it's interesting. Anyway, we're going to hear from Fionn Davenport, who's usually to be found on our Golf Weekly and our Ryan Line podcast. But he sent us a really insightful voice note about what actually makes a great sports documentary.
In terms of what makes a good sports documentary, ultimately is that I don't want to see athletes, I want to see people. Like, I want like that human side that Full Swing tried to do. I think you want to see flaws, I don't know, relationships, pressure, ego, history, all of that stuff. Like, otherwise you can't emotionally invest in someone. So that's it. I want to, like, and it can be love them or hate them, you know, but like I need to care about them one way or the other. And then almost as though the sport itself becomes secondary, although the sport or accomplishment or failure in that sport becomes the vehicle by which we kind of watch the human story unfold. So, you know, obviously the best documentaries, they make the consequences feel like absolutely laid them out on the table. So what they're trying to win, what they're trying to prove, what they stand to lose. So, and it's not just like a match or a game or a league. It's all about like identity and a livelihood, like a sense of legacy, belonging. And like the best ones, they fold it in authentically. So it's not, you know, the kind of like the sport documentary version of a reality TV show where it's like, oh, I'm singing this song because my aunt who helped raise me, she got sick when I was very young, and tears. And that formula just feels now very formulaic. So it's about folding that connection to the humanness of somebody, folding that in without making it so overt or obvious or cynical. And then you want, ultimately, like a great sports documentary has a story that builds. So it's not just like a set of highlights. So like you want a good narrative arc. You want like setup, tension, turning points, and payoff. And obviously, like, you want great access, you know, but like ultimately the structure is the thing that turns footage into like compelling drama.
He speaks so eloquently. I almost feel like we should just let Fionn run the pod.
Don't say that.
He will, he'll be in. It's funny the way he was talking about, it's the way you use the footage and the narrative arc that you build, because that's something that Drive to Survive, and I'm not too sure about Full Swing. I did watch episode 1 and 2 as kind of homework for this podcast this week, and I am going to watch the rest of it because I'm so into golf this year after all of McIlroy's success. So I'm not sure if they do it. I think they do, where each episode has its own narrative arc, and it's not necessarily a chronological order of events of the season. It's mini stories within this wider sport, and that's why it's been so successful.
And some people really dislike that. They really, really do not like the fact that it jumps from kind of 1 month to another to follow one certain storyline, and then in the next episode you're back at the beginning of the season or whatever. Drive to Survive does this a lot, where say they'll, if one episode is focused on Ferrari and a certain plot within Ferrari, they'll follow that for maybe 3 months of the season, and the next episode could be about Red Bull and they'll go back a bit.
Yeah,
so maybe you're seeing some things again, but you're seeing it from a different perspective, in my opinion, which is why I think it's been so successful with Full Swing and with Drive to Survive.
Yeah, and I think exactly that's what makes it appealing to people who don't watch the sport in day in and day out. Whereas I think maybe, and I know we're going to hear from someone who does watch F1 day in day out later, but maybe if you are watching the sport, you've seen it all and you know the way it comes, and then to watch it all jumbled up is a little bit, what's the word, jarring?
Discombobulating.
Yeah. Discombobulating. But yeah, sorry, did you have something to say there?
Yeah, you might be worried, like, if, as the true sports fan, that things will be taken out of context. Whereas you know, like, oh, he's reacting like this because this happened, or, you know, she's underperforming here, but, like, it's not, like, actively reflected if it's not done chronologically. And I can understand how you'd be worried if you were a real fan of the sport that these non-fans are going to get the wrong idea.
Yeah, Drive to Survive is particularly guilty on that front of rejigging storylines and manufacturing drama and manufacturing, you know, arguments that maybe aren't taken or are not given within a full context. But in terms of Full Swing, that's another thing that we want to ask Fionn about. Like, why is this one of only two surviving Netflix docuseries?
Well, it worked. It made golf feel far more human, I think, than technical. So, like, it was full of personality. It was, like, all, you know, they felt the pressure of competitive golf. And then there was these you know, insight into private moments, and I guess stuff that even non-golf fans gonna get hooked and go, oh, look, it's a real human being. I know from the stats that there was definite, like, a Netflix bump for the PGA Tour. So the tour released this data afterwards that 63% of full swing viewers watched PGA Tour coverage in the 2 months after the release, which could be overlapping with existing PGA Tour watchers because inevitably it's a self-selecting group. So PGA people who like golf will watch full swing. But the key stat I thought was that 11% were new or returning viewers who hadn't watched in the previous 6 months, so that there was like a conversion.
That was very interesting. I have some stats of my own. Not to be shown up by Fionn there on my own podcast. But it, Full Swing, I thought this was interesting. Netflix has, like, it kind of releases its viewership numbers. It only started doing that, I think, in 2023. But you can kind of have a look at how everything's doing, all of their shows. In the first half of 2023, so when Full Swing came out, it did 53 million hours viewed. So it was 274th in Netflix's rankings. And just as a random contrast,
I loved this.
I thought this was really interesting.
Wait, I haven't seen this yet.
Emily in Paris season 2 came out at the same time and only did 200,000. Yeah, that's meant to be 200,000 more views than Full Swing. And for me, I felt like Emily in Paris was everywhere.
I think of those 200,000 extra views, a solid 150,000 of them are my father.
For Emily in Paris?
Yeah.
What?
He loves it.
That's so interesting.
He also will watch Full Swing, so maybe it's like he's most of those.
He's combining all of those, giving both.
Yeah,
mad. So but yeah, I thought that was interesting because it kind of give it for me. That gave me a it did very well because I felt like Emily
that's
in
the
Paris.
Bar.
Yeah, that is the bar. Emily in Paris. That's still going, by the way. I really don't know how.
It's like Emily in Paris and then Rory in Rome.
Emily in Paris is pretty. I will hear no. Bad words said about Emily.
Silly,
in Paris.
But yeah, it's
she's
good
still
TV.
There. She's still in Paris.
No, she's in Italy at the moment.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah.
But in contrast, in like just for context, Drive to Survive in its first or season 5, but the first one when Netflix started tracking or making it available to the public, it did 90 million. So not quite double, but almost. Breakpoint in the tennis only did 30 million in its first season, and then season 2 only did 13. So it kind of makes sense why it was dropped. And then Six Nations only did 14 million. Mm-hmm. So literally a full half of Breakpoint, which wasn't even seen as a success in itself. So that kind of just shows you, from a Netflix point of view, why are they getting rid of things? But then also, I thought it was interesting, there was an article on golf.com which spoke about, obviously we know why the documentaries are good for Netflix, but as you were saying earlier, why the Netflix shows are kind of good for the sport. And it said, the viewership data that I was talking about in about Full Swing shows that if every audience member watched Full Swing in its entirety and only once, which apparently is a statistical impossibility, but this author says it was worth using for the sake of demonstration, the show would have reached 6.63 million viewers in the first 4 months of its existence, which makes it one of the most watched pre-produced golf shows ever. And only the Masters and its 12.1 million viewers averages a higher total than that number. So the amount of people watching golf through this show just basically blows out of the water the amount of people watching golf on TV in a normal event.
I would well believe that because I mean, I myself at home, I don't own a television in like where I'm living and I don't have a Skybox or anything. I do have Netflix on my laptop.
Mm.
It's a lot easier for me to access like Full Swing than it would be for me to watch like whatever Sky are showing at the moment.
That's a very good point because there was something else somewhere I was reading that said, you know, fans are being priced out of stadiums, which we're seeing all the time. Like in rugby, especially, the tickets are astronomical. So you can't go. So this is a way of being part of the experience when you're not able to kind of get your bum on a seat. But that's also a separate thing when you can't even watch it on TV because you don't have a TV or you're not going to pay for 7 different
subscriptions. Oh my God, so many different ways. And you need so many different channels right now. Premier League football is like the most egregious example. You have so many different subscriptions you need to watch.
You've hit a nerve.
The football I don't want to watch. It's ridiculous.
But no, I could go down that road in rugby too. But sorry, Rachel.
The golf, it probably worked as well because golf is such a, is probably quite polarizing. You know, if people, it can be intimidating. You're not just going to tune in. The Masters and the Ryder Cup may be an exception.
Yeah.
Because it's such a technical game. It's so slow compared to tuning into a rugby game or a football game. So I'm not surprised that the viewership is so high because I'd say you just got to have a lot of people going in because you have household names like Rory McIlroy. Everyone knows who he is. But I think Fionn does say why. Like it's great to have access to him and get to know them as a person. But it just opens up the sport a little bit more. It makes it a little bit more accessible.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And you have to give up, what, 3 days to watch a golf tournament rather than 60 minutes of a match. I was going to say something else there.
Well, then can I swoop in with my own point and steal your thunder there for a second? Remember we were talking earlier about kind of how Laker Gael focuses on retired players, whereas if they were dealing with active players, it would be very different. I think Full Swing is the biggest example of that, because there was this incredible scene, I think it was season two. I remember watching it, where Keegan Bradley is told that he hasn't made the Ryder Cup team for 2023. And even though by his points kind of total for that year, he probably should have. And it's this really emotional, really heartbreaking scene of him in his house. And he's kind of sat down. He got this phone call and his young kids are there and everything. And then a year later, Keegan Bradley is given the captaincy of Team USA for the Ryder Cup as an active player. As in, he can't play. He didn't end up playing it himself, but he's the youngest captain since 1963. And I don't know, would there have been such a drive to appoint him as captain if people hadn't seen that very intimate, vulnerable moment of him being so devastated at missing out at the Ryder Cup team, because it means so much to him. So then for him to be given the captaincy, to have the Ryder, which is the Ryder Cup being in New York, and then to lose it that badly, I mean, this next season of Full Swing, if there is any of the same level of insight into Keegan Bradley.
Oh my gosh.
I don't think it's sensationalizing things or making, you know, a mountain out of a molehill to say that Full Swing is a little bit a part of why he got chosen to be captain of Team USA.
Yeah, well, I never thought about it like that, because that was the one standout moment for me as well. And I remember feeling so sorry for him, like, oh, this such a good guy, and he's kind of not in the in boys club, like, you know, he wasn't invited to dinner, and you felt so sorry for him. And then, like, full 360 on my opinion of him leading up to the Ryder Cup, then I'm like, this guy is such a...
And for any of the Golf Weekly listeners, that was all they were talking about on Golf Weekly for the whole lead up to the Ryder Cup. It was like, why the hell is Keegan Bradley been given this captaincy, and how is it going to go? And the poor guy, it went horribly.
From
their perspective.
Yeah. I do think we should point out that when Full Swing came out, it was like immersed in drama already, because the season covered the kind of split between the PGA and the rise of LIV.
Yes.
So, like, I think a lot of people probably went to it being like, I want to know more about this. Let's watch how people reacted to it. But that kind of links into, we need to move on to the F1, and that everything in Drive to Survive is drama. Like, that's how they've... And I think it's not a stretch to say that's how they've done so well. They have drama. I mean, it's a luxurious sport to begin with, so people like watching that. But also the characters, like, you almost couldn't have scripted them better if you wanted to create a reality TV show.
And sort of, speaking of timing, like, for Full Swing, it was the PGA versus LIV. And for Drive to Survive, it was... F1 was bought by Liberty Media, an entertainment company, in 2017. 2018, they're inviting documentary cameras into their sport, which is a very sort of... entertainment industry idea. And then season two, so which documents 2019 season, came out just as COVID happened. So everyone's at home, they're going, what am I going to watch?
That's why I watched it.
Exactly. There's two seasons of Drive to Survive. So suddenly, so many people are watching it that by the time F1 comes out of lockdown, they have more American fans, they have more young fans, they have more female fans. And every season has just got bigger and bigger, because like the timing of everything really couldn't have been more perfect. And at the same time, for people who were fans of F1 prior to 2018, this hasn't necessarily been what they have wanted the sport to become.
Sounds like you're obviously a Formula One fan. What did you think of Drive to Survive?
I really dislike it. I think it's very over-dramatised, and I think they skew a lot of the facts. But for a new fan getting into the sport, it's brilliant. It definitely teaches them sort of the basics. But I've been watching it for as long as I'm alive, pretty much. So no, not really a fan.
Would you rather the sport kind of get out there and get a wider audience, or stick to the facts, so less of the Formula One, the Drive to Survive kind of thing?
Part of me would say, oh, let's keep it nice and niche, but absolutely, for the success of the sport, it needs Drive to Survive, it needs stuff like that. It needs to grow. The commercial side of it has grown tenfold since Drive to Survive's creation. So overall, it's a good thing, but not for me.
Yeah, I think it's fair enough. I can see where he's coming from, but then being on the flip side of that, I am that other person who I actually couldn't even... I don't think I could have told you a single F1 driver prior to 2018. Maybe Max Verstappen because he's Dutch, but not even, I can't remember thinking about it before.
You obviously weren't a Top Gear head growing up.
I was a Top Gear head, but I watched their like trips abroad to places. I was going to say Afghanistan, but I don't think they went to Afghanistan. But they did go to some really
hard-hitting geography in today's show for everybody listening.
But you're right. The kind of, I think the general public wouldn't have had a really in-depth understanding of F1. And what I found interesting, and I'm not entirely sure how true this is, but apparently, according to people associated with the production team behind Drive to Survive, that it had started off, they wanted it originally to be about Red Bull, like a documentary series about the Red Bull team. And you can really get that impression in season one.
I loved Red Bull.
Yeah, they're presented.
Maybe that's why.
That's kind of it. They're presented as the protagonists of season one.
Did they have Ricciardo in season one as well? See, he was just class, though. I think I fell in love with him and then through that Red Bull.
He really benefited from this, again, what we were talking about, from showcasing active athletes in their sport. He was shown in such a good light, and he got so many new fans from this. It did wonders for his PR career, while at the same time his racing career sort of went down the drain.
Fizzled. Actually, we were talking about the Dallas Cowboy Cheerleaders show off air, and we weren't going to bring it in because we weren't sure we'd have time. But speaking of people who have benefited on an individual basis from documentaries around their sport, that one, like all the, not all of them, but a lot of the cheerleaders now have become influencers, have brand deals, like have millions of followers on their Instagram accounts, and are building careers for themselves away from the cheerleading. Because it's interesting, and we have a clip in a second, but what the documentary really shows, apart from the fact that cheerleading is one of the most insane sports out there.
So demanding.
Oh my gosh, these girls are full-on athletes, potentially more than the NFL players. I mean, that's a bit of a stretch maybe, but definitely equal. And apart from, so it shows that, but it also shows kind of a lot of things that are wrong with the organization and the way the cheerleaders are being treated. And there's a lot of stuff on like that they're not being paid enough. I think somewhere in season one or two, one of the girls says they earn the same as a part-time Chick-fil-A worker. And they have two jobs usually because they can't live off the money the cheerleading provides. So they're working all day, going to training after work, putting in a full like shift at training, and nobody kind of knew about it. So that's been brought to light. But I'm not sure who it was. Was it a friend of yours that sent you this clip?
Rachel, yes. A different Rachel.
Another Rachel?
Another Rachel. There's many.
Many Rachels.
Oh, all right. Here's one of them.
The Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders series is definitely an eye-opening watch. You gain a massive appreciation for the amount of athleticism and dedication involved. And you also come away with this sense that these girls are not being adequately compensated for the amount of training that they do. The show, it really highlights how valuable the cheerleaders are to the Dallas Cowboys in terms of generating profit. But at the same time, it's made clear that these girls are seeing precious little of this profit themselves. There's a lot of talk about how it's an honour and a privilege to serve as a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, and that they do it for that sense of pride. But I highly doubt pride is paying the bill when they are forced to go for hip and knee surgeries to deal with the strain they're putting their bodies under.
Yeah, America's Sweethearts is the name of that documentary if you haven't seen it yet. It's, I think there's two seasons now and they are incredible.
Yeah, but don't watch that. Watch Cheer instead.
No.
Yeah.
Cheer.
I have heard of that. That follows competitive cheerleading in colleges, right?
Yeah, and that shows even more so, I think, than the Dallas Cowboys, how athletic they are, because they've got male and female cheerleaders, so they are being, launched up in the air, and the injuries that some of them have are outrageous, and they're still going. It's brilliant. The first season, second season, not so much.
That's a recurring theme.
It is a recurring theme. It's like they run out of ideas after the first season. But that's I wonder where cheerleading, I can't speak, where cheerleading will go from there. Because obviously one of the benefits for the Dallas Cowboys girls is that they've gained this huge following and they're getting money from that and like brand deals separate ways. But will it have the same impact as, say, the F1, where people will turn and watch cheerleading?
I would say no, because, and I'm going to tangentially link this to something like the Six Nations documentary, in that the reason why F1 does so well is because, or Drive Survive does so well, is because it takes you over a whole season. The cheerleading, there isn't maybe as much of a narrative to follow. And the reason that the Six Nations one perhaps didn't do as well is that it's, what, 3 weeks? You're looking at such a short space. I know it deals with the whole, you know,
6 weeks or so, but
But it's such a short period of time. And I know it goes into players' backstories and everything like that. But you don't have this long narrative, which is why I think Drive to Survive has worked. Why I think the Full Swing has worked, because it takes you over kind of a full season of the golf tour. Maybe why the Tour de France one is cancelled, because again, that's like a few weeks of the year.
Yeah, I get you. It's also, I think, with Drive to Survive, I mean, we know that they at times potentially, I don't want to say straight away from the truth, but definitely twisted things to make it seem like people said things that they didn't say. I think it was Verstappen who stepped out for two seasons because he didn't like how he was being portrayed.
Yeah.
So that was difficult in terms of for the people involved, but for the viewers, it's what makes it so excellent. I think with the Six Nations, they were very wary of that happening and they didn't want to give Netflix the access that the likes of F1 or Full Swing did. You did get a few really good stories. I mean, Bruno was talking about Andrew Porter just before we came on air and everything you learned about him and his family and his childhood, which that was incredible, but that's almost a standalone interview in a wider show. And then the show didn't have the same drama or narrative arc that Fionn was talking about to make you want to watch the next episode. You might as well just watch the Six Nations and then read an interview about Andrew Porter.
Would it have been better, maybe? Because we're talking and we're focusing so much on documentary series.
Mm.
Are we losing the art of just the hour and a half long documentary? Would that have been a better way to view? Kind of I would rather sit down and watch an Andrew Porter documentary.
Mm.
Put it that way.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
Because
someone out here snap that up?
But can I just I guess say my favorite sports documentary is a standalone, and it's Icarus. I've been talking about this in the office for days now because it came out, I think it's like 2017-18. It's a few years ago now, but it won an Oscar, and it's this cyclist, and I'm pretty sure that his name is Brian. Something.
Google loading.
But it's a cyclist who took Brian Fogel. He took performance enhancing drugs in order to see how far he could stretch his body to try and, like, because cycling is such an intense sport of endurance. He wanted to see how, you know, how much he could improve under performance enhancing drugs. But in trying to obtain these drugs or working with people who could safely administer them and everything like that, he uncovered so much about the Russian doping scandal.
Mm.
And this documentary just completely shifts in a different direction. And I just remember watching it and being astounded at the production of it, at the storylines that it was bringing you through from a sport I don't really have that much interest in, and a protagonist who I didn't know. I think that could have been, Six Nations could have done that for people. Obviously, they don't have a massive doping scandal to catch your interest. But in terms of, it's a sport people maybe don't fully know and characters they don't fully know.
Mm.
And if the only one you can think of at the end of it is Andrew Porter, it's probably not a good sign. There's only one.
Well, and Marcus Smith. But I feel like they tried to do to him what they did with the F1, which was make him this luxurious character. But then it didn't really fit in rugby in the way it fits in F1. And then people hated him for it.
Which is not fair, you know?
So, yeah. You touched on something there that made me think of something, but I'm losing my train of thought in this podcast. So let's just skip to another sports. This is a film. So it's not a series, but it was a film that came out post kind of Lions Action in 1997. And Brona said, we basically just have to include this because of how iconic the words are.
You have an awesome responsibility on the 8 individual forwards' shoulders. Awesome responsibility. This is your fucking Everest, boys. Very few ever get a chance in rugby terms to get for Everest, the top of Everest. You have the chance today. Being picked is the easy bit. To win for a line, for the Lions in a test match, is the ultimate. The only way to be rated is to stick one on them. To get it right up in their faces and turn them back, knock them back, outdo what they can do, outjump them, outstrum them, outruck them, outdrive them, outtackle them, until they're fucking sick of it.
Yeah.
That's what Bruna says to us in the box every week before we go out and record.
We just listen to that on repeat.
You know that totally real brick wall behind us? Yes. I want to run through it.
Oh, for him.
For him.
That's from the Living with the Lions documentary film that followed the 1997 British Lions tour to South Africa. And that's just an example of access, I think. Look what access can give you. They got in there, they filmed a coach in a dressing room showing us the lengths not only coaches go to and the passion they have to get their players kind of up and ready for a game, but like what it meant.
And if we're talking access, embarrassed to say that I haven't seen this in full yet, but if you say documentaries to anyone in the GAA world, they will immediately say A Year Till Sunday is their favourite GAA documentary. And basically, it follows Galway in their 1998 run up to winning the All-Ireland. But the sub keeper was a filmmaker as well.
Oh, wow.
So he recorded it on like a camcorder.
Oh, that's
so it's
amazing.
Like as behind the scenes.
as personal
as you can get. Wow. Like you'd never get away with it now. But that just shows that like you're in the dressing room with it. You're doing the drills practically with them and access to all the players, and obviously they trust him because he's a teammate. So
that's cool.
Yeah, if there's a bar for getting access, I think that's it.
Yeah, because we had an Instagram comment from Mick about that. He had mentioned
Mick.
A Year Till Sunday, friend of the pod. He also mentioned Hell for Leather, Miko, the Dub Story of a Season. We had another comment from Connor who said Blue to Gold, which I think is only released in December. It's Tipperary's All Ireland story. Apologies to Rachel sat beside me.
Do you want to touch on football? Because we're 40 minutes deep here and I'm cautious we don't want to keep the listeners too long this Thursday.
I'm going to briefly touch on football because I feel like it's been done to death now, the football documentary series. Because when you're talking about something like the access you get for that Galway GAA one or the Lions one, it's kind of a really unique way of getting in a dressing room. It's, you know, for the Lions, it hadn't really been done to the extent that it's been done now. For that one, it's, you know, your teammate you trust. Football, there was a stretch of time where Amazon were doing all or nothing documentaries. So they went to Manchester City, they went to Tottenham, they went to Arsenal, and they would bring cameras in the training facilities, match days, dressing rooms. And yeah, they were good. And I watched the Tottenham one and I enjoyed it. But like former captain Hugo Lloris, it's like wrote a book and he mentioned in it that, you know, the players felt muzzled for a year. They'd be in their own dressing room where they're supposed to, you know, feel safe and secluded. And they had to watch their mouths and watch what they were doing because they have these cameras right in their faces. Like Mikel Arteta has said, it really disrupted his team. Ruben Amorim, who's recently been sacked by Man United, vehemently opposed having cameras in the dressing room. And at the
maybe
end,
he should have left them in.
Maybe he should have left them in.
He could have showed them to the board and be like, look, I'm actually
look
doing great
I'm
stuff
with.
Here.
Look what I'm trying to do. So I feel like the level of access that you get now for football seems, they're so cautious that it doesn't even feel real.
It's fake access.
It's like, fake access, you know. It's not even PR access. It's just like it seems boring because what you're looking at is players who are like, I'm very conscious there's a camera beside me. I'm not going to say or do anything. So, I would far rather watch something like Full Swing than watch another football docu-series going into this.
Yeah, I think that is, and probably where we're going to finish up as well. That's the kind of, it's a bit of a double-edged sword here in that access gives you good TV. Too much access gives you bad TV. And it's almost maybe, is there a bit of a too much of it going around? Like, I read somewhere that all the shows, even Drive to Survive, their viewership has been dropping year on year. So is it just a little bit of a saturated market?
I think so. Can I use my word in the studio to quote somebody actually else?
Of course.
This is Aaron Timms, who wrote in The Guardian. He said, in sport, the age of perpetual content is upon us and it is viciously uninteresting, which I think is what maybe these things are running a risk of hitting into.
Yeah. Rachel, Word in the Studio.
Word in the Studio is my favourite sports documentary. Is a thing called Last Chance You. It came out on Netflix 10 years ago now. The first couple of seasons were based in American football and it's based in Mississippi for the first while, and it's like a junior college, so it's a lot of guys who have the talent to play like Division One and they should be playing at the top colleges, but for whatever reason they've been getting in trouble, their grades aren't up to it, they get sent to these junior colleges, and before you'd watch it, you'd hear those stories and you'd be like, oh, like, just go to class and like just stay out of trouble and you're probably going to make it to the NFL. You'd say like, why are they doing these things? But then it follows the players and like you go and see their hometowns and you see what they're actually putting up with. And it's like, God, it's no wonder you fell into trouble. You know, like they're set up to fail a lot of the time. But and then you're rooting for them. Like you, all you want to do is for them to succeed. Whereas at the start you're saying, cop on. But towards the end, you're rooting for them so much. First season, phenomenal. Really, really good. They did a basketball season as well in the last couple of years. But yeah, get on it.
Lovely. I don't really have a word in the studio and I think you both covered it very well. So we're going to end the pod here. If you have any sports documentaries that we missed or that you want to tell us about, you can reach us on the socials at Off the Ball, or you can always WhatsApp us at 0879 180 180. And we'll be back next week with more Word on the Street.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah. I believe in my county and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12. I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.